content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. And now, from the fiction section of the January 3rd and 10th, 2022 issue of the New Yorker magazine, What the Forest Remembers by Jennifer Egan. Once upon a time, in a faraway land, there was a forest. It's gone now, burned. And the four men walking in it are gone too, which is what makes it far away. Neither it nor they exist anymore. But in June 1965, the redwoods have a velvety, primeval look that brings to mind leprechauns or djinns or fairies. Three of the four men have never been in these ancient woods before, and to them the forest looks otherworldly, so removed is it from their everyday vistas of wives and children and offices. The oldest, Lou Klein, is only 31, but all were born in the 1930s and raised without antibiotics, their military service completed before they went to college. Men of their generation got started on adulthood right away. So, four men moving among trees whose trunks resemble the muscular thighs of giants. When the men throw their heads back to search the sunlight for the tree's pointed tips, they grow dizzy. That's partly because they've just smoked marijuana, not a common practice in 1965 among squares, which anyone would agree these four are. Or three of them. There is a leader. There is usually a leader when men leave their established perimeters. And today it is Quinn Davies, a tanned, open-faced man, accoutred with artifacts of a Native American ancestry that he wishes he possessed. Normally, Quinn would wear a blazer, like the rest of them. But today, he's donned what strikes his pals as a costume. A purple velvet coat and heavy moccasins that prove far better suited to navigating this soft undergrowth than the Oxfords they're sliding around in. Only Lou manages to keep pace with Quinn, despite the fawn-like skittering this feat requires of him. Lou would rather look spastic than risk falling behind. These men all moved to California recently, driven by a hunger for space that couldn't be satisfied by old cities, with their tinge of Europe and horse carts and history. There is an ungoverned feel to California's mountains and deserts and reckless coast. Quinn Davies, the only bachelor in the group, is homosexual, and was on the lookout early for a graceful exit from Bridgeport, Connecticut, where his family has lived for generations. After the Navy, he followed the beats to San Francisco, but now that he's here, they've proved maddeningly elusive. Still, there are always sailors who share Quinn's view that a man can be a multitude of ways, depending on the circumstances. He has a flickering hope about one of the other three men, Ben Hobart, from Minnesota, married to his high school sweetheart, a father of three. But it's too soon to tell. All four work in San Francisco in banking, doing their part to feed an expansion that will draw more restless folk like themselves to the city. Over drinks on Montgomery Street a few weeks back, they got to talking about grass, as marijuana is known, even to those who have never seen it. They know that grass is around, but what is it exactly? What does it do? All four like to drink. Quinn Davies drinks so that those around him will drink too, which occasionally makes possible unexpected adventures. Ben Hobart drinks because it subdues a greedy energy that can find no outlet around his wife and kids. Tim Breezley drinks because he's depressed. But that isn't a word he would use. Tim drinks to feel happy. He drinks because, after several bourbons, he's overcome by a sensation of soaring lightness, as if he'd finally set down a pair of heavy valises he didn't realize he was carrying. Tim Breezley has a complaining wife and four complaining daughters. Inside his small Clement Street house, he floats in a tide of shrill feminine discontent that followed him here all the way from Michigan, ranging from aggrieved and exhausted, his wife, to shrinking and infantile, the baby. A son would have made the difference, Tim is convinced, but drinking helps. Oh, it helps. Well worth the two bent fenders, the broken taillight, and the multitude of dents he's made in the Cadillac. No matter how much Lou Klein drinks, and he drinks a lot, a part of him is always removed, watching with faint detachment as the men around him get plastered. Lou is waiting for something. He thought it was love until he met and married Christine, whom he worships. Then he thought it was fatherhood, then moving west, as they did 2 years ago. But the sensation of waiting persists, an intimation of some approaching change that has nothing to do with Christine or their kids or the house in Belvedere on a man-made lake, where Lou swims a mile each morning and sails a little sunfish. He's become the social impresario of their cul-de-sac, organizing cookouts and cocktails, even a dance one night last summer. Dozens of neighbor couples swaying barefoot by the lake to Sinatra and the Beatles. At Christine's urging, he unearthed his sax and played it that night for the first time since his jazz combo days at the University of Iowa, mildly electrified when everyone clapped. Life is good. It's perfect, really. Yet Lou is haunted by that sense of something just beyond it, something he is missing. Charlene, whom they call Charlie, is six. This morning she scrutinized Lou, wrinkling her sunburned nose, and asked, "Where are you going?" "Short trip north," he said. "Some fishing, a little duck hunting, maybe." "You don't have a gun," Charlie said. She watched him evenly, her long, tangled hair raking the light. Lou found himself avoiding her eyes. "Oh, the others do," he said. His little boy, Ralph, clung to him at the door, pale and dark-haired, Christine's coloring, her iridescent eyes. It's the strangest thing when Lou holds his son, as if their flesh were starting to fuse, so that letting go of him feels like tearing. He has a guilty awareness of loving Ralph more than Charlie. Is that wrong? Don't all men feel that way about their sons, or at least those lucky enough to have sons? Poor Tim Breezley. There will be no fishing, no hunting. What Quinn divulged that afternoon on Montgomery Street as they drank and smoked their parliaments and roared with laughter before driving their big cars home to their wives and kids was that he knew of some Bohemians who grew grass in the middle of a forest near Eureka. They welcomed visitors. "We can go overnight on a weekend sometime, if you like," Quinn said. And they did. "How can I possibly know all this? I was only six and stuck at home, despite my fervent wish to come along. I always wanted to go with my father, sensing early, or so it seems looking back, that the only way to hold his attention was to stay in his presence. How can I presume to describe events that occurred in my absence in a forest that is now charred and exudes an odor like seared meat? How dare I invent across chasms of gender, age, and cultural context? Trust me, I would not dare. Every thought and twinge I record arises from concrete observation." Although getting hold of that information was arguably more presumptuous than inventing it would have been. Pick your poison. If imagining isn't allowed, then we have to resort to gray grabs. I got lucky. All four men's memories are stored in the collective consciousness, at least in part. Surprising, given their ages, and downright miraculous in my father's case. He died in 2006, 10 years before Mandela's Own Your Unconscious was released. So how could my father have used it? Well, remember, the genius of Mandela's founder, Bix Boughton, lay in refining, compressing, and mass-producing as a luscious, irresistible product technology that already existed in crude form. Memory externalization had been whispered about in psychology departments since the early 2000s, with faculty speculating about its potential to revolutionize trauma therapy. Wouldn't it help you to know what really happened? What you've repressed? Why does my mind, for example, wander persistently to a family party my parents took me to in San Francisco around the time this story takes place? I remember scrambling with a bunch of kids around the roots of an old tree, and then being alone in someone's attic beside a white wicker chair. Again and again, scrambling with those children, then alone in an unfamiliar attic. Or not alone, because who took me there and why? What was happening while I looked at that chair? I've wondered many times whether knowing the answers to those questions would have allowed me to live my life with less pain and more joy. But by the time one of my father's caregivers told us about a psychology professor at Pomona College who was uploading people's consciousnesses for an experimental project, I was too wary to participate. A gain is also a loss when it comes to technology. My father's imploding recording empire had taught me that much. But my father had little to lose. He'd had 5 strokes and was expiring before our eyes. He wanted in. Rolf had been dead for years, and my other siblings were elsewhere. So it fell to me to greet the young professor, who wore red high-top sneakers, along with his 2 graduate students, and a U-Haul full of equipment early one morning at my father's house. I parted the sparse remnants of my father's surfer shag and fastened 12 electrodes to his head. Then he had to lie still, asleep, awake, it didn't matter, and there wasn't much of a difference at that point, for 11 hours. I'd moved his hospital bed beside the pool so that he could hear his artificial waterfall. It seemed too intimate a process to let him undergo with strangers. I sat next to him for most of the time, holding his floppy hand while a wardrobe-sized machine rumbled beside us. After 11 hours, the wardrobe contained a copy of my father's consciousness in its entirety. Every perception and sensation he had experienced starting at the moment of his birth. "A lot bigger than a skull," I remarked as one of the graduate students wheeled over a hand truck to take it away. My father still wore the electrodes. "The brain is a miracle of compression," the professor said. I have no memory of that exchange, by the way. I saw and heard it only when I reviewed that day from my father's point of view. Looking out through his eyes, I noticed, or rather, he noticed, my short, uninteresting haircut and the middle-aged gut I was already starting to acquire, and I heard him wonder, "But here isn't the right word. We don't hear our thoughts out loud exactly. How did that pretty little girl end up looking so ordinary?" When Own Your Unconscious came out in 2016, I was able to have the wardrobe's contents copied into a luminous 1-foot square yellow mandala consciousness cube. I chose yellow because it made me think of the sun, of my father swimming. Once his memories were in the cube, I was finally able to view them. At first, the possibility of sharing them never crossed my mind. I didn't even know it was possible. The collective consciousness wasn't a focus of early marketing for Mandala, whose slogans were "Recover Your Memories" and "Know Your Knowledge." My father's consciousness seemed like more than enough, overwhelming, in fact, which may be why I began, with time, to crave other points of view. Sharing his was the price. As the legal custodian of my father's consciousness, I authorized its anonymous release, in full, to the collective. In exchange, I'm able to use date and time, latitude and longitude, to search the anonymous memories of others who were present in those woods on that day in 1965, without having to invent a thing. Let us return to the men scrambling behind, or in my father's case, alongside Quinn Davies, their guide. The introduction to grass took place at the trailhead, where Quinn passed around a small pipe, refilling it several times. Most people didn't get high on their first exposure. This was good old-fashioned pot, mind you, full of stems and seeds, long before the days of hydroponic sensimilla. Quinn wanted to get his first smoke out of the way to prime his pals, Ben Hobart in particular, for getting well and truly wasted later on. A river flashes in and out of view, far below, like a snake sliding among leaves. As the men climb, their stumbling and guffawing yield to huffing, wheezing, and struggle. All four smoke cigarettes, and none exercise the way we think of it now. Even Ben Hobart, one of those preternaturally fit guys who can eat anything, is breathing too hard for speech by the time they crest the hill and glimpse A-frame, as the house is known. Tucked in a redwood clearing and built from the cleared redwood, A-frame is the sort of whimsical structure that will become a cliché of 70s California architecture. But, to these men, it looks like an apparition from a fairy tale. Is it real? What kind of people live here? Compounding the eeriness is Simon and Garfunkel's Sound of Silence, eking from hi-fi speakers facing outward on the redwood deck. A-frame's mastermind, Tor, has somehow managed to get electricity to a house in the middle of a forest that is accessible only on foot. "Hello, darkness, my old friend." A hush of awe engulfs the men as they approach. Lou falls back, letting Quinn lead the way into a soaring cathedral of space whose vast triangular windows reach all the way to its pointed ceiling. The scent of redwood is overpowering. Quinn introduces Tor, an austere eminence in his 40s with long, prematurely white hair. Tor's old lady, Bari, is a warmer Zaftig presence. An assortment of young people mill about the main room and deck, showing no interest in the new arrivals. This odd setup leaves our three newcomers unsure what to do with themselves. Lou, who can't tolerate feeling like a hanger-on, is abruptly angry with Quinn, who speaks quietly and privately with Tor. What the hell kind of greeting is this? Nowadays, a man ill at ease in his surroundings will pull out his phone, request the Wi-Fi password, and rejoin a virtual sphere where his identity is instantly reaffirmed. Let us all take a moment to consider the isolation that was customary before these times arrived. The only possible escape for Lou and his friends involves retracing their steps through the forest without breadcrumbs to guide them. So Lou paces around A-frame in a way he cannot seem to help, though he feels its disruption, barking occasional questions at Tor, who sits aloft on a tall wooden chair that looks irritatingly throne-like. "Nice place, Tor. What sort of work do you do? Must have been hell getting pipes laid this far out." Lou opens doors and peers inside redwood-smelling nooks that are what pass for rooms in this kooky place. He's stopped cold in one room by the sight of a dark-haired girl sitting naked on the floor, cross-legged under a small window, her eyes shut. Tree-filtered light dapples her flesh and the dark spread of her pubic hair. Her eyes open slowly at the intrusion. Lou chokes out, "Beg pardon, I'm awfully sorry," and slinks away. The desultory group begins at last to congregate around Tor in preparation for getting high. The Yardbirds are playing, but the world of their music is too far from Lou's own world for him to enjoy it. Still, he welcomes the sense of incipient coherence, a fresh structure of meaning. Tor has a knack of orchestrating such moments. Intimate of Kerouac, occasional lover of Cassidy, future provider of LSD for Keezy, Gravy, Stone, and the rest, Tor is one of those essential figures who catalyze action in other people and then fade into non-existence without making it into history. By my count, there are 17 revelers: Tor and Barry, R4, the naked girl Lou was surprised by, now clothed in a loose flowered dress and meeting his gaze without embarrassment, and sundry others who look to be in their late teens and early 20s, who live in A-frames several outbuildings and farm Tor's marijuana crop. Lou vastly prefers Tor's totem-like bong to the diminutive pipe he smoked with Quinn. In the course of an hour's communal smoking and record changes, the group drifts into a state of blinkered absorption that is unprecedented for Lou, Tim, and Ben, who until now have only known booze as a means of consciousness alteration. Basic exchanges elongate like time-lapse fruits ripening and dropping into outstretched hands. "This grass was grown around here?" Ben Hobart asking Tor. "Yeah, the crop is walking distance," Quinn answering Ben Hobart. "You live up here full time?" Lou asking Tor. "We finished building a year ago," Barry answering Lou. Tor, you may have noticed, says virtually nothing. He has a story too, but I can't tell it. He and Barry are childless, and there are no intimate memories in the collective to scavenge from. Since Tor will pass away long before the era of Own Your Unconscious, we have only these glimpses of him through the eyes of his acquaintances. There are still some mysteries left. When a widespread high has been achieved, the group gathers at a long table. Or, rather, the men gather. Barry and the other women ferry to and from the kitchen a lavish vegetarian meal in bowls and on platters. To Midwestern men whose days start with pork sausage and end with beef stroganoff or corned beef hash, or better yet, steak or roast, the term vegetarian meal is an oxymoron. What can it mean? For Lou, it means the most delicious repast he's ever consumed in his life. Although, given the stoned arousal of his appetite, hardtack and warm water would have prompted similar raptures. Barry serves squash and turnips and tomatoes from her garden, along with tahini sauce, something our visitors have never tasted, but can well believe was harvested from the Elysian fields. Then come bowls of sorghum and buckwheat, chewy and wheat and warm, served in towering piles that they devour in spoonfuls, together with tufts of alfalfa sprouts and sliced avocados and Barry's fresh-baked whole wheat bread. As I watched all this through my father's eyes, I found myself asking a question he was likely too stoned or disoriented to ask for himself. Why? Why are Tor and Barry and Quinn, for that matter, giving the red carpet treatment to three squares who are entirely on the consuming end of the business? Well, how many reasons could there be? Money or sex? Pick your poison. For Quinn, it's sex, which he's had before with men at A-frame, including Tor once, and which he's hoping he'll have tonight with Ben Hobart, based on nothing more than a hunch. For Tor, it's money. He's run through most of his inheritance building this place and planting 10 acres of marijuana. He could use an investor or two. But there's a deeper reason. Tor has thrown himself into creating an alternate world, but hardly anyone has seen it. As a person who feels most alive in the act of awakening others, he longs to witness his vision ablaze in new eyes. Toward the end of the meal, the sun drops behind the mountains, leaving the redwoods silhouetted like iron cutouts through the windows. As if at a signal, the young denizens of A-frame leave the table and begin removing instruments from the nook where Tor and Barry store them. Bongos and castanets, shakers and recorders and ukuleles, plenty of options for those who can't carry a tune. The formerly naked girl appears with a clarinet that must be her own. Several people have guitars, and Tor carries a flute. They begin to leave the house, walking in twos and threes along a path that leads uphill through the redwoods. Lou and his friends are swept along into the cool, fragrant woods. Quinn dares to sling an arm around Ben Hobart's shoulders, causing a rogue flash of electricity to judder down Ben's spine. He glances at Quinn, deeply startled, and doesn't move away. Tim Breezley trudges along at the rear. He'd like a drink. Smoking grass has drained his energy, and added to the weight of his invisible valises is that of a mandolin that someone handed him to carry. He's the last to reach the hilltop, and when he does, the redwoods give way to cleared land, and it's sunny again, the final rays browsing among the serrated leaves of a waist-high marijuana crop. Tim Breezley's mood lifts in this openness and light. The air has a dry, tart snap. A circle has already been cleared for bonfires on cold nights, and the group assembles there, as if by habit, each putting down instruments to take the hands of those adjacent to them before they sit. Emboldened by their earlier success, Quinn seizes Ben Hobart's hand, eliciting jolts of sensation in Ben that approach the orgasms he has with his wife. Lou happens to find himself beside the formerly naked clarinetist, but his legs won't really cross. He hasn't sat Indian style since boyhood. Once seated, they all close their eyes, as if in meditation. I've witnessed this silent period from every available consciousness in the collective, and I have glints of what ran through each mind as they sat together in the dregs of sunlight. First communion on a rainy morning, scooping black goldfish from a pond, a ringing in his ears, the sensation of landing a backflip. But my problem is the same one that everyone who gathers information has. What to do with it? How to sort and shape and use it? How to keep from drowning in it? Tor breaks the silence with the first and only sustained utterance his guests will hear from him today. In a thin voice, he asks them to feel the presence of a higher power in the food they've eaten, in the land beneath them, and in the sky above, to feel the uniqueness of this moment of the 20th century, to forget briefly the scourge of wars and apocalyptic weaponry in favor of this beauty, this peace. Feel it, my friends, Tor says, and be grateful for our blessed convergence. A vibration seems to roll up from the warm earth. The sun slips behind the mountains with a click of cold, an intimation of the Pacific Ocean snarling at cliffs just a few miles west. Tim Breezley finds that his eyes are wet. He wipes them discreetly as the others begin to play their instruments, and then he gives the mandolin a tentative strum. A guitarist with a fledgling beard leads the group, along with the clarinetist, through Michael Rowe, The Boat Ashore. It's a song these two know from the church they went to as kids. They're an older sister and a younger brother, like Rolf and me. The array of instruments and harmonizing voices has a rousing effect. Barry floats to her feet and begins to dance. The others do the same, still playing their instruments. Quinn and Ben Hobart dance together, hands fiercely clasped. Tim Breezley sways with his mandolin. All of them move, together and apart, in the fading light. Lou and Tor alone remain seated. For Lou, my father, the music and the dancing provoke a riot of alarmed awareness, as if he were remembering a flame left on, a door left open, a car left running beside a cliff. With a prescience that will distinguish him to the end of his life, Lou understands that the change he's been waiting is upon him now. He has reached its source, can feel it in the soles of his feet. But he knows that he's too old to partake. He's 31, an old man. Still, Lou Klein won't tolerate being left behind. He must catapult himself into a producer's role, like Tor, who's older than he is, for Christ's sake. Not by growing grass. Agriculture is too redolent of the Iowa landscape he left behind. But the music, there he can do something. He remembers the night in his cul-de-sac when everyone danced by the lake. Different dancing, different sound. The Yardbirds and their ilk have nothing to do with the life Lou Klein planned for himself, the one he's living now. They belong to the life he'll live next. He watches the brother and sister musicians and imagines them together on a stage. He thinks, I can put them there. And he does. We all know their music today. Late that night, after Tor and Barry have gone to bed and Quinn Davies and Ben Hobart have disappeared to parts unknown and some others have returned to the cleared land to make a bonfire, fire danger being a threat even then, Lou and Tim Breezley and the sibling musicians and their young friends descend the mountain to the river for a night swim. Lou leads the way. He has always been drawn to water. He goes barefoot, a big improvement over his Oxfords, and downright sensuous on this carpet of velvety decay, as if sharp objects didn't exist. The river is smooth and still, pressed between walls of redwoods, and so cold that their fingers throb when they dip them in. Could swimming in it harm them? Lou has heard of very cold water causing heart attacks, and feels responsible having led everyone here. As they're mulling over the safety of submerging, Tim Breezley suddenly strips off his clothes and dives from a log, buck naked. The smash of cold stops his breathing. He has a brief blackout sensation of death. But when he surfaces, howling, what has died is his sorrow. He's left it on the river bottom. Freedom! Joy! Tim Breezley will soon divorce. They'll all divorce. Everyone will divorce. An entire generation will throw off the fetters of rote commitment in a favor of invention, hope, and we, their children, will try to locate the moment we lost them and worry that it was our fault. Tim Breezley will become a dedicated jogger before anyone jogs without being chased. He'll write books about exercise and mental health that will make him a household name, and will receive thousands of letters from people whose lives he has transformed, even saved. Cursing himself for not having jumped in first, Lou sloughs off his clothes and hurls himself into water so frigid it sends his nuts into his throat. There are splashes and screams as everyone follows him in. But when the agony passes and they've paddled around a bit, the cold reverses itself and becomes radiant heat. They leave the river, tingling and euphoric, bound by their adventure, and scramble back up the mountain to A-frame, naked and unashamed. We waited at the window, Ralph and I, for our father to come home. Eventually, we went outside into our cul-de-sac. Our mother let us go barefoot, although we'd already had our bath. It was a warm summer twilight. I wore a paisley brown orange bathrobe, but I don't think I truly remember that. I have memories that are really just pictures from the albums our mother loved to make, telling our family story in small square photographs, still mostly black and white, with an occasional blaze of color as if everyone had woken up in Oz. That paisley bathrobe came back to me only when I watched our father's approach to the house through his eyes. I felt him note the blue beauty of the hour and experience the surge of love that overwhelmed him at the sight of Rolf in his cloth diaper running toward him on stumpy 3-year-old feet. We seized our father's legs, and he put a hand on each of our heads, cupping Rolf's and holding it against him. And then he looked up at our mother, Christine, who smiled at him from the front door in a blue sweater, her dark hair falling from a clip. All around her were the spindly saplings they'd chosen together at a greenhouse and planted outside their brand new California home, assuming that they would live there forever. Next, from the book section of the January 3rd and 10th, 2022 issue of the New Yorker magazine, How Politics Got So Polarized. In a new era of hyperpartisan identities, can anything bring us and them together? By Elizabeth Colbert. On June 19, 1954, 11 boys from Oklahoma City boarded a bus bound for Robbers Cave State Park, about 150 miles to the southeast. The boys had never met before, but all had just completed fifth grade and came from middle-income families. All were white and Protestant. When they reached the park, the boys were assigned to a cabin at an empty Boy Scout camp. They dubbed themselves the Rattlers. The following day, a second group of boys, also all white, Protestant, and middle class, arrived at the camp. They were assigned to a cabin that could not be seen from the first, and they decided to call themselves the Eagles. For a week, the two groups went about their activities, swimming, tossing a baseball, sitting around a campfire, unaware of the other. The groups had separate swimming holes, and their meal hours were staggered, so they didn't meet at the mess hall. As they ate, played, and tussled, each band developed its own social hierarchy, and, hence, its own mores. The Rattlers, for instance, took to cursing. The Eagles frowned on profanity. Toward the end of the week, the two groups learned about each other. The reaction was swift. Each group wanted to challenge the other to a contest, and their counselors scheduled a tournament. On the first day, the Rattlers won at both baseball and tug-of-war. The Eagles were livid. One of them declared that the Rattlers were too big. They couldn't be fifth graders. They had to be older. The Eagles, on their way back to their cabin that evening, noticed that their rivals had attached a team flag to the backstop of the baseball field. They tore it down and set it on fire. The next morning, the two groups got into a fist fight, which had to be broken up by the counselors. That day, the group's positions reversed. The Eagles won the baseball game, a development they attributed to their prayers for victory and to their rivals' foul mouths. Then they won at tug of war. The Rattlers responded to these setbacks by raiding the Eagles' cabin after the Eagles had gone to sleep. The Eagles staged a counter-raid while their adversaries were at breakfast. Finding their beds overturned, the Rattlers accused the Eagles of being communists. As tensions mounted, both groups became increasingly aggressive and self-justifying. The Rattlers decided that they'd lost at baseball because the Eagles had better bats. They turned a pair of jeans they'd stolen from the Eagles into a banner and marched around with it. The Eagles accused the Rattlers of cowardice for having staged their raid at night. They stockpiled rocks for use in case of another incursion. When the Eagles won the tournament, each boy received a medal and a penknife. The Rattlers immediately stole them. At this point, members of both groups announced that they wanted nothing more to do with the other. But their counselors, who were really grad students, were just getting going. They brought the bands together for another contest, of the sort that only a social scientist could love. Hundreds of beans were strewn in the dirt, and each boy was given a minute to collect as many as he could in a paper bag. Then, one by one, the boys were called up and the contents of their bags ostensibly projected onto a screen for everyone to account. In fact, the bags were never opened. The same beans were projected onto the screen over and over in different arrangements. The Rattlers saw what they wanted to, and so did the Eagles. By the former's reckoning, each Rattler had gathered, on average, 10% more beans than his rival. By the latter's, the Eagles were the better bean picker-uppers by a margin of 20%. The whole elaborate experiment is now regarded as a classic of social psychology. The participants have been chosen because they were so much alike. All it took for them to come to loathe one another was a different totem animal and a contest for some penknives. In the aftermath of the Second World War, these results were unsettling. They still are. Americans today seem to be divided into two cabins, the donkeys and the elephants. According to a YouGov survey, 60% of Democrats regard the opposing party as, quote, a serious threat to the United States, end quote. For Republicans, that figure approaches 70%. A Pew survey found that more than half of all Republicans and nearly half of all Democrats believe their political opponents to be immoral. Another Pew survey, taken a few months before the 2020 election, found that 7 out of 10 Democrats who were looking for a relationship wouldn't date a Donald Trump voter, and almost 5 out of 10 Republicans wouldn't date someone who supported Hillary Clinton. Even infectious diseases are now subject to partisan conflict. In a Marquette University Law School poll from November, 70% of Democrats said that they considered COVID a serious problem in their state, compared with only 30% of Republicans. The day after the World Health Organization declared Omicron a variant of concern, Representative Ronnie Jackson, a Texas Republican, labeled the newly detected strain a Democratic trick to justify absentee voting. Here comes the MEV, the midterm election variant, Jackson, who served as physician to the president under Trump and also under Barack Obama, tweeted. How did America get this way? Partisans have a simple answer. The other side has gone nuts. Historians and political scientists tend to look for more nuanced explanations. In the past few years, they have produced a veritable presidential library's worth of books with titles like Fault Lines, Angry Politics, Must Politics Be War, and The Partisan Next Door. Liliana Mason is a political scientist at Johns Hopkins. In Uncivil Agreement, How Politics Became Our Identity, she notes that not so very long ago, the two parties were hard to tell apart, both demographically and ideologically. In the early 1950s, blacks were split more or less evenly between the two parties, and so were whites. The same held for men, Catholics, and union members. The parties' platforms, meanwhile, were so similar that the American Political Science Association issued a plea that Democrats and Republicans make more of an effort to distinguish themselves. Quote, alternatives between the parties are defined so badly that it is often difficult to determine what the election has decided, even in broadest terms, end quote. The 50s, Mason notes, were not a time of social peace. Americans fought, often in ugly ways, over, among other things, communism, school desegregation, and immigration. The parties were such tangles, though, that these battles didn't break down along partisan lines. Americans, Mason writes, could, quote, engage in social prejudice and vitriol, but this was decoupled from their political choices, end quote. Then came what she calls the Great Sorting. In the wake of the Civil Rights Movement, the Women's Movement, Richard Nixon's Southern Strategy, and Roe v. Wade, the GOP became whiter, more church-going, and more male than its counterpart. These differences, already significant by the early 1990s, have become even more pronounced by the 2010s. We have gone from two parties that are a little bit different in a lot of ways to two parties that are very different in a few powerful ways, Mason says. As the two parties sorted socially, they also drifted apart ideologically, fulfilling the Political Science Association's plea. In the past few election cycles, there's been no mistaking the Republican Party's platform for the Democrats. By now, party, race, faith, and even TV viewing habits are all correlated. One study, based on TiVo data, found that the 20 television shows most popular among Republicans were completely different from those favored by Democrats. As a result, Mason argues, Americans no longer juggle several potentially conflicting group identities. They associate with one all-encompassing group, which confers what she calls a mega identity. When people feel their mega identity challenged, they get mega upset. Increasingly, Washington politics, and also Albany, Madison, and Tallahassee politics, have been reduced to us versus them, that most basic and dangerous of human dynamics. As Mason puts it, we have more self-esteem real estate to protect as our identities are linked together. Mason draws on the work of Henri Tajfel, a Polish-born psychologist who taught at Oxford in the 1960s. Tajfel, a Jew, was attending the Sorbonne when the Second World War broke out. He fought in the French army, spent 5 years as a German POW, and returned home to learn that most of his family had been killed. In a series of now famous experiments, Tajfel divided participants into meaningless groups. In one instance, participants were told that they had been sorted according to whether they'd over or underestimated the number of dots on a screen. In another, they were told that their group assignments had been entirely random. They immediately began to favor members of their own group. When Tajfel asked them to allocate money to the other participants, they consistently gave less to those in the other group. This happened even when they were told that, if they handed out the money evenly, everyone would get more. However, given a choice between maximizing the benefits to both groups and depriving both groups, but depriving them, the other group, of more, participants chose the latter. It is the winning that seems more important, Tajfel noted. Trump, it seems safe to say, never read Tajfel's work, but he seems to have intuitively grasped it. During the 26th campaign, Mason notes, he frequently changed his position on matters of policy. The one thing he never wavered on was the importance of victory. "We're going to win at every level," he told a crowd in Albany. "We're going to win so much, you may even get tired of winning." In January 2018, Facebook announced that it was changing the algorithm it used to determine which posts users see in their newsfeed. Ostensibly, the change was designed to promote meaningful interactions between people. After the 2016 campaign, the company had been heavily criticized for helping to spread disinformation, much of it originating from fake Russian-backed accounts. The new algorithm was supposed to encourage back-and-forth discussion by boosting content that elicited emotional reactions. The new system, by most accounts, proved even worse than the old. As perhaps should have been anticipated, the posts that tended to prompt the most reaction were the most politically provocative. The new algorithm thus produced a kind of vicious or furious cycle. The more outrage a post inspired, the more it was promoted, and so on. How much has the rise of social media contributed to the spread of hyperpartisanship? Quite a bit, argues Chris Bale, a professor of sociology and public policy at Duke University, and the author of Breaking the Social Media Prism, How to Make Our Platforms Less Polarizing, published by Princeton. Use of social media, Bale writes, pushes people further apart. The standard explanation for this is the so-called echo chamber effect. On Facebook, people friend people with similar views. Either they're genuine friends or celebrities and other public figures they admire. Trump supporters tend to hear from other Trump supporters and Trump haters from other Trump haters. A study by researchers inside Facebook showed that only about a quarter of the news content that Democrats post on the platform is viewed by Republicans and vice versa. A study of Twitter use found similar patterns. Meanwhile, myriad studies, many dating back to before the internet was ever dreamed of, have demonstrated that when people confer with others who agree with them, their views become more extreme. Social scientists have dubbed this effect group polarization, and many worry that the web has devolved into one vast group polarization palooza. It seems plain that the internet is serving for many as a breeding ground for extremism, precisely because like-minded people are connecting with greater ease and frequency with one another, and often without hearing contrary views. Cass Sunstein, a professor at Harvard Law School, writes in At Republic, Divided Democracy in the Age of Social Media. Bale, who directs Duke's Polarization Lab, disagrees with the standard account, at least in part. Social media, he allows, does encourage political extremists to become more extreme. The more outrageous the content they post, the more likes and new followers they attract, and the more status they acquire. For this group, Bale writes, social media enables a kind of micro-celebrity. But the bulk of Facebook and Twitter users are more centrist. They aren't particularly interested in the latest partisan wrangle. For these users, posting online about politics simply carries more risk than it's worth, Bale argues. By absenting themselves from online political discussions, moderates allow the extremists to dominate. And this, Bale says, promotes a profound form of distortion. Extrapolating from the arguments they encounter, social media users on either side conclude that those on the other are more extreme than they actually are. This phenomenon has become known as false polarization. Social media has sent false polarization into hyperdrive, Bale observes. Several recent books on polarization argue that if, as a nation, we are to overcome the problem, we have to start with ourselves. The first step is for citizens to recognize their own impairments. Taylor Dotson, a professor of social science at New Mexico Institute of Mining and Technology, writes. Peter T. Coleman, a professor of psychology and education at Columbia, counsels, think and reflect critically on your own thinking. We need to work on ourselves. Robert B. Talese, a philosophy professor at Vanderbilt, urges in Sustaining Democracy, What We Owe to the Other Side, we need to find ways to manage belief polarization within ourselves and our alliances. The trouble with the partisan heal thyself approach, at least as this partisan sees it, is twofold. First, those who have done the most to polarize America seem the least inclined to recognize their own impairments. Try to imagine Donald Trump sitting in Mar-a-Lago munching on a Big Mac and reflecting critically on his own thinking. Second, the fact that each party regards the other as a serious threat doesn't mean that they are equally threatening. The January 6th attack on the Capitol, the ongoing attempts to discredit the 2020 election, the new state laws that will make it more difficult for millions of people to vote, particularly in communities of color, only one party is responsible for these. As the Times columnist Ezra Klein points out, the great sorting in American politics has led to a great asymmetry. Our political system is built around geographic units, all of which privilege sparse rural areas over dense urban ones, he writes in Why We're Polarized. This effect is most obvious in the U.S. Senate, where each voter from Wyoming enjoys, for all intents and purposes, 70 times the clout of her counterpart from California, and it's also clear in the Electoral College. It's more subtle, but according to political scientists, still significant in the House of Representatives. Klein says that the Republicans, with overrepresentative rural counties on their side, can afford to move a lot further from the center than the Democrats can. The GOP's geographic advantage permits it to run campaigns aimed at a voter well to the right of the median American, he writes. Conversely, to win, Democrats don't just need to appeal to the voter in the middle, they need to appeal to voters well to the right of the middle. Republicans, Klein notes, have lost the popular vote in 6 of the past 7 presidential elections. If they had also lost the White House 6 times, presumably they would have come up with a broader, more inclusive message. Instead, in 2000 and then again in 2016, despite having lost the popular vote, the GOP won. This could easily happen again in 2024. Such is the state of the union these days that no forum seems too small or too sleepy to be polarized. In October, noting a disturbing spike in threats of violence against local school board members, the U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland directed the Justice Department and the FBI to come up with a plan to combat the trend. Predictably, Garland's directive itself became the focus of partisan attacks. At a hearing on Capitol Hill, Senator Tom Cotton, Republican of Arkansas, accused the Attorney General of sicking the feds on parents at school boards across America. You should resign in disgrace, Cotton said, wagging his finger at Garland. If thoughtful examination isn't going to get America out of its rut, what is? According to Stephen Marsh, a novelist and a former columnist for Esquire, the answer is obvious. At the start of his book, The Next Civil War, Dispatches from the American Future, he states, the United States is coming to an end. And that running battles between protesters and militias, armed rebels attempting to kidnap sitting governors, uncertainty about the peaceful transition of power, reading about them in another country You would think a civil war had already begun. The next civil war might be called a work of speculative nonfiction. Some parts are reported, others invented. The book is structured as a series of possible disasters, each of which sends the U.S. spiraling into chaos. Each of Marsh's scenarios results in a different form of social breakdown. The carnage at the bridge is followed by a simmering insurgency, the Capitol bombing by government repression, widespread rioting, and summary execution. Towards the close of the book, Marsh entertains the possibility that the U.S. could be broken into four separate countries, roughly corresponding to the Northeast, the West Coast, the Midwest, plus the Southeast, and Texas. Disunion could be liberation, he notes. The robbers' cave experiment suggests another way out. After having nudged the Eagles and the Rattlers toward conflict, the researchers wanted to see if they could be nudged back. They brought the boys together for a variety of peaceable activities. One day, for example, they arranged for the two groups to meet up in the mess hall for lunch. The result was a food fight. Since contact situations weren't working, the researchers moved on to what they called superordinate goals. They staged a series of crises. A water shortage, a supply truck breakdown, that could be resolved only if the boys cooperated. Dealing with these manufactured emergencies made the groups a lot friendlier toward each other, to the point where, on the trip back to Oklahoma City, the Rattlers used $5 they'd won from the bean-collecting contest to treat the Eagles to Maltitz. Could superordinate goals help depolarize America? There would seem to be no shortage of crises for the two parties to work together on. The hitch, of course, is that they'd first need to agree on what these are. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Well, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.